Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Kimberly Jones, representing Appellant Donald Metzger. The administrative law judge's decision here should be reversed, as there is no substantial evidence to support the ALJ's finding that this plaintiff was not disabled and could return to his past work. This plaintiff is 60 years old at the time of his alleged disability onset date. He was obese, weighing 280 pounds, and is 5'10", with several severe impairments, including coronary artery disease, herniated disc in his neck, and diabetes. The ALJ found the plaintiff could return to his past work, where he worked for the past 20 years as a traveling salesman, where he was also vice president of sales and owner of the company, where he worked on commission, working 10 to 12-hour days. He drove 45 to 50,000 miles per year, going to construction sites. He was always on the road. He was never in an office. And he worked at this job until he was 61 years old and found that he was too fatigued to keep his sales up. The ALJ found the plaintiff had the capacity to return to this work without any walking or standing limitations. And to begin with, the ALJ's failure to make any finding on the plaintiff's capacity for standing or walking is an error of law, as she is required by Social Security Ruling 96-8P to assess plaintiff's work abilities on a function-by-function basis, which means the ALJ should have explicitly stated how long the plaintiff could work, could stand or walk in an 8-hour day. Furthermore, the ALJ based her decision without any medical evidence as support. In fact, she rejected every medical opinion on the record, including state agency doctors and treating doctors, and she based her residual functional capacity finding on her own lay person opinion. In doing so, the ALJ acted contrary to Seventh Circuit law, which is clear on the proposition that an ALJ commits harmful error by playing doctor and making a medical conclusion without evidentiary support.
Let me just say this. I know that you recognize that you face a strong uphill battle here in asking us to upset an administrative law judge's determination. What is your strongest argument that the judge's decision was not supported by substantial evidence? Is it the fact that the standing and walking requirement wasn't noted? What is your strongest argument?
That the ALJ did not rely on, there was no medical opinion in the record that supported the ALJ's finding. It appeared that the ALJ basically found lack of complaints at a later date to support her finding, and that she did not come up with any walking or standing limitations for someone who is a traveling salesman and was supposed to return to his past work, working 10 to 12-hour days on the road all the time. There was no findings in the record. No doctor said that he could perform such unlimited walking and standing.
Wasn't there some testimony about 15 minutes? That's about all he could stand?
Yes. The plaintiff testified at the hearing that he could only stand or walk for 10 to 15 minutes, and the ALJ cited no reasons to discredit his testimony for that. In fact, medical expert Dr. Freeman testified at the hearing that his impaired cardiac condition, obesity, age, diabetes, and hypertension supported that testimony, that he could only walk or stand for 10 to 15 minutes. Furthermore, the cases in the Seventh Circuit cases, Cavalli versus Sullivan, Rohan v. Chater, Bowser v. Bowen, and Blakes v. Barnhart, all stand for the proposition that an ALJ commits harmful error when making an independent medical evaluation without relying on any physician's evidence as support. Here, we had two state agency physicians who found that the plaintiff could only stand for 2 hours and sit for less than 6 hours. This was confirmed by a third state agency physician once he reviewed the report. And medical expert Dr. Freeman found the plaintiff could only stand for 4 to 5 hours at 30-minute intervals. And it's quite notable that had the ALJ accepted any of these RFCs and had given the plaintiff any walking or standing limitations, the plaintiff would be limited to light or sedentary work, which would direct a finding of disabled under the medical and vocational guidelines. But the ALJ found the plaintiff could do more than light work, finding that he could perform unlimited standing and walking at 10 to 12-hour days. Furthermore, the ALJ's reasons for summarily dismissing each medical opinion is without merit. For instance, the ALJ found that Dr. Freeman merely deduced symptoms from the lab reports that he reviewed, but all that is required by Social Security Regulation 404-1529 and Rule 96-7P is that medically determinable impairments exist and that those impairments could reasonably be expected to produce the types of symptoms complained of by the plaintiff. Here, both the impairments and the related symptoms cited by Dr. Freeman in his report were well documented in the record, and that is all that is required by the rules. The ALJ further dismissed the findings of her own experts, the state agency physicians, even though according to SSR 96-6P, state agency doctors are experts, and their opinions are entitled to significant weight when consistent with the rest of the opinions on the record, which is the case here. Furthermore, the ALJ improperly discredited the plaintiff's credibility, asserting that the treatment notes don't support plaintiff's statements regarding pain and fatigue, and that his impairments seem controlled after fall of 1998. However, the record is replete with plaintiff's complaints, and his treatment notes continue well after fall of 1998, including treatment notes on an almost monthly basis with Dr. Sani from February of 99 to February 2003.
Ms. Jones, how do we factor in the ALJ's finding that Mr. Metzger was exaggerating his disabilities when speaking to doctors who could influence his disability application, but not when speaking to treating physicians? That's a problem, isn't it?
Well, essentially, as time went on, when he was being treated by Dr. Sani for almost 3 or 4 years, his complaints did taper off a little bit, but that's because he stopped working. He decreased his exertional activity. He structured his daily activities in a way that he was not exerting himself, so he wouldn't have chest pains. And he didn't exaggerate. In the hearing, he testified that he did not have chest pains anymore. He further testified that he had to keep his neck at a steady, kind of bent down. He couldn't look left or right, or else he would feel shooting pains down his neck and through his arms. And he testified, that's why I don't have those pains, is because I keep my neck in this manner. And so the ALJ basically did not follow 96-7P, which states that, which requires the ALJ to consider whether daily activities are structured so as to minimize symptoms to a tolerable level or eliminate them entirely. And that's exactly what happened here. The plaintiff testified that from that his activities now consist of puttering around the yard, maybe for 1 to 2 hours at a time, and then he takes significant breaks in between. And the ALJ's failure to consider those structured activities is error. Moreover, the fact that the plaintiff continued to see Dr. Sani on an almost monthly basis until February 2003 is evidence that he was still suffering from the same impairments. The bottom line here is that there is objective proof that the medically determinable impairments existed and that these impairments could reasonably be expected to produce the types of symptoms that the plaintiff complained of. So 96-7P and 404-1529 have been met, and that's all that is required for the credibility determination. I'll reserve my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Police Court, my name is Mark Mates, and I'm appearing on behalf of the Commissioner. Your Honor, the argument of Mr. Metzger appears to be premised on the fact that he had severe impairments and therefore should be found disabled. But part of 96-7P, which has been advocated pretty strenuously, is the way that the complaints are raised to the treating sources of record. And we have a judge who, certainly in a very detailed decision that went 15 pages long, single space, went through the record with a great deal of thoroughness. And what she noted, particularly at page 26 of her brief, was that while he had these conditions, they tended to be conditions that required treatment for a brief period of time, were stabilized, and that he was able to move forward. And what she considered was that the heart condition treatment seemed to revolve around 97, for a short period of time in 98, he had difficulties with neck problems and arm, and that his depression first emerged around February of 99. When we look at the treatment notes, which under 96-7P would be highly significant evidence, we see that his complaints with regard to his primary impairments are rather limited in time, and particularly when we talk about Dr. Sani, pretty much after February of 99, there aren't really significant complaints relating to the heart condition or fatigue or anything of that respect. He does, in February of 99, mention that he was tired all the time, but there's nothing after that. And as counsel pointed out, we have treatment notes that go forward through 03. Throughout those notes, the claimant is indicating that he was feeling better, that things were, that he was doing well, and he was also complaining about other impairments at that time. So it wasn't by any reticence, I think, on his part to complain. I mean, he had some difficulties with pink eye. He had some itching of the eyes, and he got treatment for that.
Well, I'm particularly concerned about Dr. Freeman's opinion that Mr. Metzger was suffering from organic dementia. Was there sufficient evidence that the administrative law judge carefully considered all of his mental health conditions?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, the remand order from the appeals counsel specified that the administrative judge was to get a psychological consultant, and she, a consultant's opinion, and that was Dr. Gordon in November of 2002. And
well, actually, the appeals counsel order said to obtain a psychiatric examination.
It's psychiatric examination with psychological testing.
And yes, but psychiatric means, well, something quite different.
I think that the administrative judge looked at that and understood that to mean that a psychologist could go ahead and perform that evaluation. And after having obtained it, she proffered it to counsel. There was no objection by counsel.
Well, see, that's why I'm worried about the organic dementia problem. Organic dementia is something that psychiatrists look at because they are MDs. They have, you know, the medical training. That is not something that psychologists ought to be looking at unless it is so, you know, obvious.
Well, it would seem to be a rather significant impairment that a psychologist ought to be able to see some indication of. And when we look at the bases for some of those concerns, like the IQ test results, which I think is what Dr. Freeman was highlighting, some of the differential performance on that, you know, his performance on those test results was average, I think, particularly with regard to
pretty
the...
pretty low to me for... You know, 97. Of course,
well,
all of us.
Well, his ultimate diagnoses were, I believe, Dr. Gordon found that he had chronic mild dysthymia with an adjustment disorder with depressed mood. And in terms of the organic dementia, Dr. Freeman had an opportunity to review these reports. He did provide a written report. He considered Dr. Gordon's report, and in that report really made no mention of it, where I think in a six-page report he went into a rather significant amount of detail with regard to the other impairments. I think part of the inconsistency between his written statement and his oral statements posed a great deal of concern for this judge, who went, I think, into a great deal of detail in her discussion of his statements, particularly with his rather elaborate statements with regard to the listings that were pretty much wholly unsupported. I think he had referenced that he met the listing for the heart condition 404C as of 96, and that would have required a statement that this claimant was unable to perform exercise stress testing because it was risky, and yet he had that in 97.
Is it legal error, as Ms. Jones maintains, that the standing and walking requirement is not?
I don't know, Your Honor. I mean, the ALJ expressly considered the state agency physicians, I think, on the second to last page of her decision. And what she pointed out was that there really wasn't any support for the posture limitations ascribed. I mean, the ALJ found here, essentially, that Mr. Metzger's limitations were that he was limited to 20 pounds of lifting occasionally and 10 frequently. That was it. She looked at all of the record evidence, and she couldn't find anything to justify greater limitations. And although Dr. Freeman had indicated that this was attributable to diabetes, cardiac enlargement, and hypertension, the ALJ observed that those were really based on complaints, but that the record indicated, you know, by on the contrary, that Mr. Metzger wasn't reporting those type of complaints to his treating doctors. And Dr. Sani's progress notes his diabetes was controlled, his hypertension was controlled, he was taking Prozac for anxiety and depression at 436A. He was doing well, and he continued to do well after that. And with regard to sitting, Dr. Freeman, on whom counsel relies, indicated that there were no limitations on sitting whatsoever. This isn't a case of an ALJ, you know, rejecting without a basis physician opinion. She looked very closely at all of the evidence of record, and she considered both the treatment, the medications, the side effects, and the activities, and assessed his abilities. And he himself had indicated that he could engage in activities for 6 hours at a time, and 6 hours a day and 2 hours at a time. So we would contend that substantial evidence does in fact support, and that the ALJ had a VE who testified as much about what this person could do in terms of their past work, given his limitations.
Thank you, Ms. Bates. Ms. Jones, how much time? You have 2 minutes, Ms. Jones.
Just a couple points. Counsel stated that there was no indication of any complaints in Dr. Sani's notes. And on page 475 of the record, on August 99, the plaintiff did complain of feeling sleepy and taking sleeping in the afternoon. And a year later, in October 2000, which is on page 480 of the record, plaintiff again complained of feeling sleepy. So those complaints of fatigue did exist throughout Dr. Sani's treatment notes. The ALJ rejected the state agency physicians based on their finding that he claimed their findings were ambiguous, if not inexplicable, because their finding that the plaintiff could stand for 2 hours and sit for less than six did not equal an 8-hour day, which is exactly the point her experts were trying to make, that the plaintiff could not work an 8-hour day. And again, 96.7P requires the ALJ to consider how the plaintiff has structured his or her activities to minimize his symptoms. Here, the plaintiff he structured his activities so that he was taking breaks throughout the day. As counsel pointed out, he testified he could do 6 hours of activity with several spots of breaks in between. That does not equal sustained working activity 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. We ask that you reverse his decision. Thank you.
Court's thanks to both counsel. Before we move to the next case, Laguerre versus McKessie.